This is the recipe for what Lily calls tater pudding, something that she associates with her youth. You grate 3 or 4 raw sweet potatoes after peeling, of course. With that, you mix the grated peel, the grated dry peel of an orange, add a dash of nutmeg, a cup of syrup, about half a stick of butter, 2 eggs, and a half a cup of flour. Mix that well and put in a flat pan about the size of the pan we use for baking chicken. Mix it up and keeping stirring it very much the way we do our custard. Put it in the oven and cook until it is firm, stirring it, and then stop stirring and let it brown. This can be cut like corn pone and can be carried, and maybe the listen, my children, and you shall hear of Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry height of the Old North Church as a signal light. One if by land and 2 if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm to every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm." Then he said good night, and with muffled oars silently rode to the Charleston shore, just as the moon rose over the bay where swinging wide its moorings lay the Somerset, British man of war, a phantom ship with each mast and spar across the sky like a prison bar, and a huge black hulk that was magnified by its own reflection in the tide. Meanwhile, his friend through alley and street wanders and watches with eager ears until in the darkness around him he hears the muster of men at the barracks door, the clash of arms and the tramp of feet and the measured tread of the grenadiers marching down to their boats on the shore. Then he climbed the tower of the Old North Church by the wooden stairs with stealthy tread to the belfry chamber overhead and startled the pigeons from their perch on the somber rafters that round him made masses and moving shapes of shade. By the trembling ladder, steep and tall, to the highest window in the wall, where he paused to listen and look down a moment on the roofs of the town and the moonlight flowing over all. Beneath in the churchyard lay the dead, in their night encampment on the hill, wrapped in slumber so deep and still that he could hear, as a sentinel's tread, the watchful night wind as it went creeping along from tent to tent and seeming to whisper, "All is well." A moment only he feels the spell of the night and the hour and the secret dread of the lonely belfry and the dead, for suddenly all his thoughts are bent on a shadowy something far away where the river widens to meet the bay, a line of black that bends and floats on the rising tide like a bridge of boats. Who was that, Lily, that you were talking to?
A friend of mine.
Oh.
You see how crazy you were.
Uh-huh.
I said, "Well, it sounded good." He said, "What did you say?" I said, "It's a nice day, you know." And I said, "You're looking fine." We had a little fun over there. Because I never heard my voice on the tape before.
Mm-hmm.
And yours didn't sound exactly like you neither.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different echo when you catch it on.
Yeah.
That's the way they catch these people, don't you? When
oh, a lot of them, yeah, sure.
There's some red bone hound in them and some bull, and they run yellow and black mostly in color, but they can be identified because while in the old days they were simply cur dogs, today they have become a separate breed of dogs that is recognized certainly by comment, and the individual dogs are recognized. There was one rope that if the calf did need tying after he was thrown, there was one rope that the cowboy had that he could use and did use for that. And that was his stake rope that he used in staking out his horse when at night when he wanted to give the horse room to graze. The bullwhip, of course, was the utensil with which the Florida cowboy herded his cattle, and the skill with which they could be used was something phenomenal. The knife, by the way, was also used for marking the cattle and marking the calves. As for the bit on the horse's reins, Remington showed a check bit with a fairly long roundups took place when the calves were still with their mothers, and they actually weren't roundups so much as a group of the cattlemen would get together and would start out in a given range and get together all the cattle that could be reached. The calves, of course, were caught by the catch dogs, and they were branded. And the wagon that came along with this particular roundup had a number of branding irons in it, oh, maybe 20 or 30, but of course there were far more brands present on that piece of range than that. So, and of course, no matter who was on the reins, they branded the cattle according to the cow the calf was with. Now, if they found a cow with a calf and did not have the branding iron in the cart, they used what was known as a running iron. It was a rod of iron. Parton indicated it was about 28 inches long with a curve at the end, and that was heated, and the brand was put on, written on instead of being stamped on as it would have been with an ordinary branding iron. This running iron was also used by the cattle rustlers to alter brands. But there was one thing that couldn't be done by the rustler, and that is, he couldn't alter a brand, and so that it couldn't be discovered in a certain way. However much the altered brand might look like an original brand, it did not look like an original brand on the underside of the skin. And if the hide were examined, it would show where the original brand left off and the alteration began. And this was used often in a court of law to convict rustlers. Mr. Parton himself told of a trial at which he was present, where the man accused the rustler of altering, accused another man of altering his brand, and when the man denied it, he was so sure that he had the particular animal butchered and skinned, and sure enough, on the underside of the skin, it showed where his original brand had been altered. When a rustler started out to operate in any special region, he worked out a brand into which brands in that section could be altered. For example, if a man had a brand P, it could be altered into B or R or any letter of that nature. And a circle could be made a circle and square, or a little more complication always was meat for a rustler. In addition to the brand, the cattle had earmarks, and today both brands and earmarks are registered in Tallahassee, so that there is no question of an overlapping of brands. When a man bought a herd of cattle with a certain brand, he bought that brand, so that in the future those cattle were recognized as his cattle because he had not only bought them, but he had bought the rights to the brand that was on them. And their progeny, who were branded according to the mother, would show as his property. As to the chuck wagon, Mr. Parton doubted if any very lengthy drive using the same cowboys would operate without a chuck wagon. And the big thing the chuck wagon did, the cook did, was biscuit, which he cooked in a big Dutch oven. And the chuck wagon cooks were adept at it, and they could make delicious biscuit. Otherwise, the cowboy, in passing the farmhouse or someplace where there was especially a notable cook, would go to the house and beg some biscuit to put in his saddlebags. Bread itself, ordinary bread, was hardly a good commodity to carry in a haversack, in saddlebags, but the cowboy had a way of getting around it. Instead of ordinary bread, he liked potato bread because it didn't dry and crumble. But one of the favorites, Parton seemed to think, was the syrup bread, which was made with cane syrup, and which might have been sticky and all, but nevertheless it remained soft and edible and cohesive, and certainly tasted good. And he remarked that many a time he had scraped the mold off the bread, off the syrup bread, and eaten it. But that was the staple. The staple breads for the cowboy were the two breads mentioned, that is, syrup bread or potato bread, because they were cohesive, and biscuit, the regular baking powder biscuit. And The horses, or on the Florida range, were not shod. It was unnecessary because the sand made soft footing, and even today the cowboys at the rodeos and the flashy cowboys seldom have shod horses, except some of the top liners that ride their horses often on hard surfaces, and they do have shod horses. A man might have a horse shod when the hoof was split in order to hold the hoof together until it could heal, in which case he went to town and had the blacksmith do it. But there was no such thing as a blacksmith on a range or on a ranch or anything of that sort, because there was no, certainly in shoeing horses, there was no call for it. On a long drive, such as the Summerlin drives, there was no such thing as a remuda. That is a big bunch of horses taken along. There might be a string of horses, some extra horses, but there were very few that weren't needed almost immediately. If a horse gave out or a horse went lame or anything like that, he was taken to the nearest town and sold, or they didn't try to doctor him, and a new horse bought in his place. Parton did agree that the cowboys themselves owned one horse, but he said most of them rode that horse until the horse gave out. They weren't replaced. He had no patience with the idea that that a cowboy rode his horse one day and turned it in to rest the next day. He said the Florida cowboy rode a horse until it was worn out. He said when he went on long trips or anything like that, he had the same horse all the way. But of course the horse was taken care of. He might have been ridden hard, but he was never ridden to the point of exhaustion by a good rider. And the drives didn't go on forever. I asked him if it was true that they had a chance to browse on the way, and he said certainly. He said that the drive would start, the long drive would start in the morning about daylight, and would go until the heat of the day came up, and then the drive would be halted, and the cattle would be allowed to graze or take their ease in any way they wanted to. But almost all of that Central Florida country was fairly good pasture land, and there was always something there for them to eat. Then along in the evening, the drive would take up again. As for Summerlin having built cattle pens at day's intervals along, he doubted if it was anything as regular as that. On any cattle drive, as a rule, the man who was running the drive sent ahead and had cattle pens built. They might be very simple cattle pens, because of course they were only to serve one night, but they might cut cypress poles, or it might be a field that was easily enclosed. But while the cowboy rode herd on the cattle, when they were halted for their noon siesta or meal or whatever you want to call it, at night he was not needed to herd the cattle because they were penned. I mentioned that Daisy had said that cattle on that Summerlin drive between St. Augustine and Ponderosa would drift 150 pounds, and he pooh-poohed that. Summerlin was too good a cattleman to let his cattle lose that much weight. Well, I said, how much did they lose? Well, he said probably they might lose 50 or 60 pounds, but that's all a good cattleman would let them lose. The drives were not speedy. They were leisurely. they didn't run the cattle, they simply let them drift along. And they stopped and browsed most of the central part of the day. Other pens were made of wire. When I asked Mr. Parton how many poles, for example, when making a pole pen, whether one pole was sufficient, he said, oh no, they used 4 or 5 poles stretched along. And speaking of catch dogs, Parton said that if a big bull even broke herd, a catch dog would stop him dead. He'd go for his nose and face, and a bull couldn't take that. He'd stop a bull in his tracks and drive him back into the herd. The old cowmen, Parton said, didn't even know what a rope looked like. In fact, the only thing they had, for example, if they wanted to tie a calf, was their stake rope that they used in staking out their horse.